Boiling Frogs Post presents Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson. Now, with the latest podcast in this series, here is Ryan Dawson.
Welcome back. Today's guest is Dr. Joseph Gerson, and the topic will be the geopolitical stage of the Pacific, and particularly China, the U.S., and Japan, the world's three largest economies. Dr. Gerson is currently the Director of Programs and the Director of Peace and Economic Security Programs for the American Friends Service Committee. His program work focuses on challenging and overcoming U.S. global hegemony. He's written a few books, Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World, with Hiroshima Eyes, Atomic War, Nuclear Extortion, and Moral Imagination, co-written with Walden Bellow. Today we're talking about nuclear proliferation in the Pacific and how not talking to each other usually has bad results. Welcome back to Boiling Frogs Post. The last time you were on, we talked about the U.S.'s Pacific pivot and how different factions all profit from rattling North Korea's cage. The problem is sometimes bluffing war sometimes stumbles into actual war. And the stage is a little bit set up like World War One, would you say?
Well, comparisons have been made to 1914 in terms of interlocking alliances. And this applies not only to the Korean situation, but also to the tensions in the South China Sea and between Japan and China. So it's this is an important time to be talking about talking and moving toward negotiations rather than rattling swords.
Yeah, exactly. And there have been also there's a lot of analysis on this saying, well, just making a big stink out of this so that they can sell armaments to everybody. But even when that's the goal, sometimes wars can break out anyway because maybe North Korea hasn't gotten the memo on that.
I think it's deeper than that. And I think what's happening is that on the one hand, as you know, with the pivot, the United States has been attempting to reinforce a particular order or disorder, if you want to call it that, across the Asia-Pacific region, you know, which has benefited the military-industrial complex, but also a number of manufacturers, many people. And with China's rise, you know, there's been a challenge to that order. And I think if we understand that with North Korea's missile and nuclear test, it too is challenging that order. You know, its missiles can certainly bring South Korea and Japan within range, and even if there isn't a fighting war, the one of the things that's looked at, as you read the papers, you can see that increasing numbers of people in South Korea are talking about South Korea becoming a nuclear power in response. And similarly, the Japanese right has been talking about this. And were those things to happen, not only would we move closer to nuclear danger, but those countries would probably feel less tied to the United States, which I think is one of the things that in turn drives the United States to be flying B-52s and B-2s nuclear-capable aircraft in the direction of North Korea to attempt to reinforce those alliances. So all those forces coming together, I think, make a particularly dangerous situation, of course, augmented by the massive U.S. and South Korean war games that have been going on.
I was going to ask you about that, because what do you make of the press again ignoring the U.S. and South Korea's joint war games and acting like North Korea's response is just some act of crazy people, like it was out of the blue?
Well, there's an old biblical tradition that talks about removing the mote from one's eye before criticizing the other. I think the mote in much of the American eye has blinded us to the ways that we've contributed to and continue to contribute to this crisis.
Do you think the new defense pact with South Korea could make an accidental war more likely?
Yeah, I don't know the pact itself makes accidental war more likely, but I think the area that I'm most concerned about right now is the third dimension of the war games, which are going to take place in the West Sea, near, possibly in, but certainly near waters which are disputed in terms of who controls them between South Korea and North Korea. So that's the kind of environment where an accident could happen, where an artillery shell or a bullet is fired in the wrong direction, either accidentally or purposefully, and engenders a response that has the potential to spiral in ways that could be very dangerous.
That's the area where it happened in 2010, isn't it?
Yeah, you had that's where the Yongping Island incident took place, and at that time, under some pressure from the United States, the South Koreans limited their response, but Park, the new president in South Korea, has essentially ordered her senior military officers, to give a massive response in the case of another incident.
Yeah. Do you think the U.S. has to accept and acknowledge that North Korea now has a nuclear bomb, that they're nuclear power? I mean, is it really a shock that North Korea sought a deterrent after witnessing what happened in Iraq and Syria and Libya?
Well, there's certainly a logic to the decision by the North Koreans to develop a nuclear arsenal. I think it's worth noting the kind of recent Chinese position, which is talking about at this stage moving toward commitments to nuclear demilitarization, but not, I'm sorry, to denuclearization on the peninsula, but without insisting this is a precondition for talks. And I think, as I've read there and elsewhere, the idea of talking about limiting at this juncture North Korea's nuclear program in exchange for reduction of sanctions, and then looking down the line toward perhaps the creation of a Northeast Asian nuclear weapons free zone that would give the North Koreans both a greater sense of security and the kind of saving of face that might be necessary.
Do you think this could set South Korea and Japan on a quest to get the bomb, assuming Japan doesn't already have one? Or, as you were saying earlier, the U.S. would actually prefer them to have that dependency and maybe move its own nuclear weapons into South Korean bases, let's say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we need to understand that it's not necessary for the U.S. to put nuclear weapons on land in Korea to hold North Korea, you know, hostage
to
genocide. I mean, the submarines and long-distance aircraft, missiles, and so on and so forth can do that. I think serious concern is that in South Korea, the polls that I've seen have indicated that two-thirds of the people favor South Korea becoming a nuclear weapons state. And in the past, South Korea did have a nuclear weapons program under President Park's father's rule. In Japan, again, there's been greater discussion both before and during this crisis about the possibility coming from the right wing of right wing sectors of the government to become a nuclear power. But at this stage, it seems that Japanese people's aversion to nuclear weapons will be sufficient to hold the government in check for some time.
Sure. There have been more than 2,000 nuclear tests and 9,000 satellite launches in the world. Mm-hmm. And to the best of my knowledge, I might be wrong, but I don't think the UN Security Council has ever passed a resolution prohibiting either one of them. But after North Korea did their launch and their third test, they became the most sanctioned country in the world. Why such a harsh reaction from North Korea?
I think the principal reasons have to do with the threat to U.S. Hegemony in the region and where a North Korean arsenal could lead. I think that's the basic reason. I think it's also interesting that I think we need to pay attention to the fact that the Chinese, much to many people's surprise, joined the United States in approving the latest sanctions, which were targeted against the North Korean elite. And I think one of the things that's happening in China is a growing sense that the North Korean arsenal and a government that threatens chaos in North Korea could undermine Chinese interests, principally in terms of precipitating a possible war, which is the last thing that China wants with its focus on economic development, which is still continuing.
Yeah, they've got everything to lose. They're on a good track. Why would they shake it? Did you see Obama's promise to reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the U.S.?
Well, you know, I saw reports that they were going to take this step, and it was anticipated that he would make a statement to that effect during his State of the Union speech. But it didn't come, I think, principally because North Korea had detonated its third nuclear bomb. But, you know, the reality is that we have to go a whole lot further. You know, Obama raised international hopes with his early call in Prague for a nuclear weapons-free world, and we really haven't seen much. Now, he's, you know, to give the devil his due, he's been somewhat caught by the resistance of the Republican-controlled House and its power in the Senate. And I think there were efforts on his part to move away from a first strike doctrine, but the Pentagon has resisted it, and he hasn't been willing to pay the price to overcome that, the political price to overcome that.
Well, part of this so-called reduction, too, was just fuzzy math, where they were doing stuff like they'd have multiple warheads on a bomber, and they would count that as one weapon rather than several.
Yeah, so that's what we have under the new START treaty. The reports that I had read indicated, I guess, in two directions. One, that the United States would reduce the size of its stockpile, and the reports that it may have reduced the number of bombs in its stockpile by 500, leaving still many thousands there. And on the other hand, was going to press negotiations with Russia for further cuts. The difficulty there is that the United States has totally violated commitments made by the first President Bush, that in the wake of the collapse of the Berlin Wall and German reunification, that we wouldn't move the NATO alliance a centimeter closer to Moscow. And of course, we've moved it right up to the borders of Russia, and they're feeling increasingly encircled. Compounding that are two other things. One, just the economic crisis in Russia that continues, which has meant that their conventional forces are not nearly as strong as they were at the end of the Cold War. And as a result, they're becoming increasingly dependent on their nuclear arsenal as they look at more dynamic forces targeted against them coming from the West. And I guess the second piece I wanted to say there was that part of that are the missile defenses that the United States is deploying in Eastern Europe, which the Russians see as complementing a first strike nuclear policy.
Obama said that those defense shields in Poland were targeted toward Iran now.
And the military buildup in Asia has been, of course, targeted only against North Korea, and we don't say a word about China. So, you know, I mean, diplomats and political leaders are going to cover their moves as best they can. But if you're a Russian these days in a senior position, you're expressing concern about those missile defenses.
Yeah, I don't even know why they tell lies that are that see-through. I mean, it's like, why even bother with it?
Well, it allows for diplomacy to continue in some ways. I mean, speaking bare truths can sometimes make things worse than they are.
I guess a politician just can't tell the truth no matter what. This is part of what they do. I want to talk Japan, too, because I see eye to eye with you on this about the whole sphere of influence being the major, I mean, many factors, but that's one of the big ones. And the U.S. has been pushing Japan for years to join the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And actually yesterday, which would be maybe a week from now by the time this goes up, but they entered into negotiations about it officially. And I'm fine with trade if that's all it was, but do you see this as a step towards solidifying economic dependence, especially in energy, in order to prevent Japan from sliding towards China? Sort of the soft power, as Joseph Nye may call it.
Yeah, we hit on several points there. The administration has referred to the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations as strategic, which in a sense says it all. I think several things are going on, but principally what the United States is looking to do is to reduce the dependence, especially of the Japanese and South Korean economies, on China, and turn them toward deeper integration with the United States. In addition to integrating their economies, or coming with integration of their economies, would be deeper integration of their societies with the United States, and if you will, into a greater West and a greater North. And the idea here is to create a so-called gold standard free trade area from which the Chinese would be excluded, or if they ultimately wanted to join, it would be so structured that there would be considerable advantage to the United States in terms of the terms that they would have to meet to come into it. A similar negotiation is now underway about to begin, I think in July, between the United States and the European Union. And both of these are also designed to create greater leverage in dealing economically with China, to counterbalance its economic rise. In both cases, as I've heard presentations about these and pretty serious analysis, the question is that these negotiations are incredibly complicated. They seek to, among other things, unify regulations to manufacturing, what's produced, how it's produced, laws, and so on, between a very diverse set of nations. And as a result, it's not going to be easy to complete these negotiations, which is something I think the Chinese are aware of too. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out. They may move for at least common denominator, which in turn would limit the success of their ambitions.
Yeah, have you had a chance to read the Nye Armitage report?
Oh yeah, back in August.
Yeah.
So just with that hint, I'll pick up on the energy piece there, which basically, you know, for those who are listening, the report is basically about how to revitalize the U.S.-Japanese alliance after a period of drift during the period of Democratic Party of Japan rule. And they essentially challenged the Japanese elite, saying that Japan has a question to answer, whether or not it wants to remain a first-tier nation, and obviously a privileged ally of the United States, or whether it wants to simply decline into being a second-tier nation. One of the interesting things is that when Prime Minister Abe came to Washington to meet with President Obama, he explicitly responded to that challenge, saying that Japan would remain a first-tier nation. A major part of that report, in addition to talking about increased U.S.-Japanese military cooperation and terming the Japanese military the most respected institution now in Japan, which I think may not be true, it calls for a
But they said according to Japanese polls, that's how they cited their evidence.
But simply to say that they describe the ambitions for the alliance also as a resource alliance, and basically is Japan is dealing with energy difficulties in the wake of the Fukushima meltdown and the crisis it caused. U.S. is making several demands. One, absolutely criminal, is that Japan restart its nuclear power plants and join with the United States in further nuclear power plant exports.
That's not going to happen.
But also that Japan increase its reliance on U.S. natural gas now that the United States with fracking is becoming a major exporter of natural gas. And again, interestingly, while Abe was in the United States, he made the commitment to purchase more natural gas. And also related to that, as part of the economic integration, there's the call for Japan to invest in U.S. Gas exploration and production as they attempt to tie the two countries together. I mean, the reports that we're reading now of one continuing leak in Fukushima after another, and you know, the continuing concern that the the meltdown was not caused by the tsunami, but by the earthquake itself, should lead the Japanese people to continue to resist the restarting of those reactors.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be, I mean, the minimal amount maybe for electricity until they can get other means, but there's a very strong anti-nuclear movement in Japan that's not going away.
I'm well aware of that, but by the same token, you know, the influence of both big business and government is not to be underestimated.
Well, yeah, not that Abe listens to the public. But there's also a new, not just the fracking going into the shale horizontally and getting natural gas, but there's a new way of extracting, I guess, natural gas, or what they, maybe it was methane hydrates or something like that.
Right.
I probably screwed up the term, from ice, which they did out of Alaska once with Japan. And I believe that was in there too. The whole report just seemed like a giant infomercial to buy natural gas from the United States.
Yeah. No, but there's also a report that the Japanese, in a recent experiment, were able to extract that from that gas from the sea. It's still in experimental mode, and of course, one of the things we don't know is its impact on the environment. And you know, the reality is that the burning of any fossil fuels further accelerates global warming, which, with all the catastrophes that it's bringing.
Sure. Well, I think it was Mike Green or one of the people in the talk were saying one of the ways of extracting it was by pumping CO2 back into the ice. But of course, where are they getting that from? They got it from burning it to begin with. But Green also said what I found interesting. He sort of slid it in the talk about the report when he's giving his speech. He said, if Japan's self-defense force could loosen some of its constraints, it would give Japan a real asset among the world. Some of constraints, meaning Article 9, perhaps?
Yeah, well, it's really quite clear. In the Armitage Nye report, it talks about removing anachronistic constraints on the Japanese military. And clearly they're pointing to loosening the impact of Article 9. Two things on that. One is that, you know, the campaign to give greater freedom for freedom of action for the Japanese military has been going on, you know, for a long time. I've watched it and heard it now for more than three decades. And you know, the reality is that Japan already is the sixth biggest military spender in the world. It sent its forces to assist the U.S. war in Afghanistan and sent troops to Iraq, in large measure, I think, to help to try to move the Japanese political debate, trying to, if you will, normalize the foreign deployment of Japanese troops. It seems at this juncture, in reality, the Obama administration, I think, is concerned about quite how far the Abe administration will go. There are really credible reports now that the U.S. actually advised the Noda government against the purchase of the Senkaku and Diu islands. And it seems that what the United States would prefer at this point to the revision of Article 9 is perhaps a reinterpretation of it that allows for more Japanese military operations. But doesn't send the powerful signal to, especially to China and to Korea, in terms of increased nationalist militarism in Japan. And I think what we're seeing is, on the one hand, the Abe government taking a publicly a low-profile approach to revising the Constitution, certainly through the elections this July, when they hope to gain control of the upper house as well as the lower house. And it seems that what they'll aim for will be to, as they always have, in a kind of salami cutting approach to revising the Constitution, they'll press to revise Article 96, which is the article that defines how the Constitution can be revised. Instead of demanding a two-thirds vote, it'll call for only a simple majority. And with that in place, down the line, they'll be in an easier position for actually removing Article 9, which is the provision that essentially says Japan won't have a military and will not engage in warfare as policy.
Yeah, unless it started. And also point out that a lot of the spending to make them the sixth largest spender is that 70% bill for the cost of U.S. bases, which the prices of which have no bearing on actual reality. They just know they can charge more, so they do.
Yeah.
But
well, I think that's part of it. But remember, Japan's got a quite modern navy. It has missiles that can reach Mars. So it's that's not insignificant.
Oh, absolutely not. I was just pointing it out because I'm not a fan of the bases. I think it actually makes it more of a target than less.
right. No, I mean, you know, one of the things that some of the people I work with in Japan were calling for in the wake of the March 11th catastrophes was to end the so-called sympathy payments and to use that money for reconstruction in Japan, which would be much better use for that money.
Yeah, build some bigger seawalls, too. Now, I know you're a big fan of John Kerry. You like John Kerry as much as I like Richard Pearl. So okay. What do you think of his statement that we will have a nuclear-free world in a couple centuries?
Yeah, well, that sort of gave lie to where American policy is going, didn't it? Look, the reality is that what Obama has pursued has been nonproliferation. Not a nuclear weapons free world, and you see with that statement, you know, the administration's priorities are pretty well revealed.
Well, I mean, but back even before all the turmoil in Syria, Assad called for a nuclear free Middle East, and pretty much everyone other than Israel joined on board. But Obama, as far as I know, hasn't even admitted. I mean, everyone knows it, but they won't even admit that Israel has nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, he's a president of the Democratic Party, and so, you know, it's not exactly as close as lips and teeth, but the relationships are pretty close, and there are political costs, unfortunately, in the U.S. Political system for being critical of Israel. So it's a tight situation.
Sure. Last question, a little fun one. Do you think we should take away Obama's Peace Medal and give it to Dennis Rodman?
Well, you know, it's going to be a little hard to get your hands on that medal, but what we might do and what we've been doing is to encourage the president to respond to what Dennis Rodman said when asked if Kim Jong-un had any message for President Obama. Rodman said that Kim had said, call me. And that's exactly what should be done. We need to be talking and not threatening a nuclear catastrophe.
But not talking always works, doesn't it?
Oh, it always works if you want the world to get worse and people to die.
Well, that's might be what they do. I mean, they end up profit. But yeah, that's the sad thing. Of course, we need a dialogue, and it doesn't have to go through a bunch of mediums saying, hey, you tell him that I said this, you know, getting Xi Jinping or somebody to talk to North Korea for the United States. There should be direct dialogue, but, you know, in an ideal world, if people were mature and not crazy and cared about each other, that would happen. But talking about government.
Basically, what we know is that in the end, conflicts are ended with all but a few exceptions. By negotiations and talks. So I think we've been spreading the message that it's important to halt the war games and begin the negotiations. It's in everybody's interest to do that.
I'm at the level of just acknowledging that there were war games and that was a bit of a provocation, and just admitting that even happened. We're at that stage still, but hopefully this July, Abe's company will fall out of favor the way, not because of all this, but because he's been destroying the yen, dropping 20-something percent since November. I don't think they're going to gain many seats. So if we could get rid of that, I don't know. Park's pretty solid in her position, but what could people do to influence our government to act more rationally in the Pacific?
Well, one of the things... Just to say that we've created an organization, or actually a network called the Working Group for peace and demilitarization in Asia and Pacific. And we've issued a couple of statements that people can find on our webpage, www.asiapacificinitiative.org. And there are lots of resources. I mean, a fairly basic piece, which I think your program helps to do here, is to educate people, because people are not going to be able to respond until they have a deeper knowledge of the politics and the policies in Asia Pacific. So we're encouraging people to do that. People who are listening to this, assuming that the crisis is going to be continuing for a while, should be calling their members of Congress, calling the White House, so that they know that there's a bit of a backlash, a swell to the military posturing here, write letters to the editor, and to exercise our democratic potential in order to maintain peace and to invest in society, which is, you know, as you know, really hurting here.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't wait for other people to do it for you, and don't think, oh, it doesn't matter. Doing nothing's an automatic forfeit.
That's right. I mean, I was surprised. I wrote a letter to the editor of the Boston Globe, essentially calling for an end to the war games and negotiations. And not only did they print it, but they printed it with a photograph, which on the one hand drew more attention to the letter, but the content of the photograph was quite interesting. It included basically it was a picture of South Koreans holding protest signs calling for talks and negotiations. Adding a kind of imprimatur from the newspaper to our call. I certainly couldn't have predicted it, and you know, the basic piece is you don't know what the consequences of your actions will be until you take them.
Yeah, got to do it. And over here on this side of the pond, too, it's been Japanese activism by the public, which is the only thing really keeping the government at bay somewhat. So, yeah, everybody take some action. AsiaPacificInitiative.org.
.org.
.org. All right, I'll link to it. I appreciate your time, Dr. Gerson.
Okay, thank you. Be well.
Be well. Take care.
That was Dr. Joseph Gerson giving us a deeper understanding of the soft power economic chess playing behind the Pacific pivot and North Korea nuclear hype. You can learn more about the Joseph Nye Richard Armitage report, the marching orders for Japan, the Tier 1, which is fancy talk for you're a man, aren't you, by going to the CSIS website. It's one of the most disgusting things you'll have to sit through and listen to, but it's very important to see the policies that are announced by these think tanks and so-called proposed trade agreements to get a better handle on the economic gameplay for geopolitical understanding.
Check back soon for another episode of Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson, exclusively here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. We'd like to thank you for your support of our work and invite you to share it with friends and ask them to support it as well.